life. But believing that and accepting that is such a very difficult
task. You need
task.
To be a man for that.
Yeah, you have to shoulder the burden. Hard times. The truth that we have to believe in life. What do you think are the biggest truth that we have to accept in life?
Biggest truth? Mm-hmm. That time will not come back.
Yeah.
The time I'm living in right now is not going to come back.
Which I can cry over that because yeah. It is very sad that time would never come back.
Yeah, because Imam Ali al-Islam also puts it that if you are told that you're going to die right now, mm-hmm. just to add 5 more minutes to your life, you'll yeah. give entire of your whatever you own, every property, everything, whatever you
oh
own,
my God.
Just to live for more 5 minutes. So yeah. Yes, the hardest truth
is that time will go. And if
time
will never
is running,
back,
it will not come back.
Yeah, it will never come back.
That's one of the hard truths.
Yeah.
What about you? What do you feel about the hard truths?
Well, without thinking, I would say in a heartbeat that it would be death. The hardest truth that we have to believe.
Okay.
I know that whole spiritual thing that we say that there is no death to the spirit, to soul.
Yeah.
But come on, that's difficult to die.
Especially for women.
I guess for every single one, but yes, for women.
Most.
Because we're attached to our body.
Body. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what makes it difficult.
No, not just that. Trust me. Because, you know,
the attachment of soul yeah. to this body yeah. is also something that makes it difficult.
And everything that is unknown is fearful. I guess that's the reason why we're scared of death.
Yeah.
And now if I die, it would be no problem because I'm going into another journey and in the rest, God would help me.
Yeah.
But when it comes to your dear ones, when mm-hmm. it comes to the people you have attachment to, it would turn the story upside down. That is where I would say the hardest truth to believe that there's some people in your life that one day they might not be there.
Yeah.
So it is killing.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Well, to me, another hardest part.
Another hard truth that we have to embrace.
Yeah. I actually recently realized that.
Which?
Which was that you cannot erase from people's brain mm-hmm. the negativity
yeah.
they have towards you. The negative thoughts they have about mm-hmm. you. You cannot erase that. You cannot replace that with the good things that you want to have. In their minds
yeah.
about yourself.
Being an impressionistic person is very sad.
Yes.
You know, sometimes you meet a person and at that very first meeting, you decide about them and that's it.
I actually started working with a person in a kind of, I must say, family.
Mm-hmm.
But not a very close relation. However, in this professional work, I was the boss mm-hmm. and this family member.
The downer position.
Just last night, the person was telling me, I'm sorry I was not able to do this work on time, but I did it on this time. I was like, it's okay, it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And the person was like, you are so kind, boss, towards me. Are you yeah. so kind in this and that sense? But the person who actually was a medium between us thinks a very negative of you. And I just stopped there and I was like, please don't explain it to me because yeah. it's going to
change my thoughts about him or her.
Yeah, it's going to just, I'm going to feel sick and it's going to be another hard truth that I have to accept.
Yes.
Because that's really hard, you know. I mean, the person comes in as a medium and you provide job for that particular person to another person. And then when you get to know this person thinks sick of you or anyone in any part of your life.
And Zainab, it happens
realize,
many times in life when
yes.
you invest in people, but
yes.
they show you the other way.
They show you their true colors or you get to know about them
yeah.
or, you know, so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
But then you actually realize that you cannot change your image in everybody's mind. Just let them think what they think.
Yeah.
This is really one of the hardest truths I had to accept.
Just go for a little break and I'll be back in no time.
Mm-hmm. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Do you believe in perfect partners?
I really don't. I'm sorry to say that on air.
Well, I have to confess that I believe that there are some perfect partners.
I don't think in
but
the current
era. But I also
era.
Have, maybe it's an illusion and one day I'd be disillusioned, but yes, it's unfortunately the truth that we have to embrace, yet I'm working on that, but still I have not came to the point where I believe in that, but we have to believe that there is no such a concept like
So the hard truth you're talking about is that there are no fairy tales.
They're
not Cinderella.
Yeah.
They're not. There's no Cinderella. There's no prince going to come and find your shoes.
They should have never told us such a story. Then why they created those stories?
Just fantasy to keep you away from the real life, so that when you enter real life and encounter the truth, you feel depressed.
You feel disillusioned.
Yeah. So. Fantasy world has a difference with the real world. It's one of the, again, hard things to admit, except not everything goes the way, not everything has a happy ending like films, the movies.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. And failures.
Yeah.
Failures are not always bad. They teach you a lot of things, but...
But at the moment, it's very difficult to understand that. When I am in the process of failure, it is very... And somebody comes to me and tells me, okay, don't worry, you're going to learn things from that. I'll punch them. Come on, how can I learn from this?
You will realize with time when you get mature enough.
Yes.
But yeah, that's again one of
when
the
I
hardest
get over
truths
that.
To accept that failures are there.
Yeah,
what I'm trying to say is that... not every success comes just as such. One of the hard truths is that failures can be there in life.
Yeah. So, Zainab, hardships are part of life.
Yeah,
that is the hardest truth to believe.
Yeah.
That things that you have in your mind, things that you have predetermined them in your brain are not exactly going to work the same way that you have planned for them.
True.
So you have plenty of obstacles, plenty of twists and round stories that might get into your story and cut all the beautiful, fantasized, fairy tale stories that you have planned in your brain.
Yes. Well, I think I am. Something is coming to my mind. Is that about?
Oh, that's very nice. You're saving me.
Relatives.
Relatives.
Again, in relations and relatives, you cannot expect everything to be going smooth all the time. That's another hard truth that you feel like life is going to be this fantasy all the time. Everything is going to be smooth. Like, I'm fine with my sister right now. I'm fine with my mother right now. I'm fine with my husband right now. But you should not expect that you're going to be fine with every one of them always.
Yes, because your best friends are those who you make most of your fights with them.
Yes, because Imam Ali al-Islam also says that, you know, one of the qualities of a hypocrite is that he's always fine in all situations with everyone. So I'm not saying a believer does
fight. Also, we have another quotation that popped out into my mind right now that says, everyone's friend is no one's friend.
Yes, exactly. That's the quality of a hypocrite.
Yeah.
So you cannot expect that hypocritic behavior in family relations.
So what I conclude, Zainab, is that everything starts from expectations.
Yes, it does.
So in living as a human being, we have to go with the flow, trust in God, find solutions whenever a problem pops out. And then...
accept hardships.
Yes. And live at the very right moment that you're living, at the present.
Yes, yes.
Do not think too much about past and do not be too much engaged in the future.
And what makes it difficult to accept hard truths, hard truths of life is being your oversensitive.
Oh, yeah.
Or being hypersensitive towards something.
Oh, yes.
It makes it difficult. So you have to act mature.
Yeah.
You have to be mature. You have to admit things, accept things.
This maturity takes so much of time and it is hard. Like those...
Anyway, they are hardships. Yeah. You have to actually compare yourself with those who are having a much harder time mm-hmm. than yours. You don't have to compare yourself with those who are having a better time. We are not recommended to yeah. do that. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, says, don't do that comparison. Even if you want to do comparison, yeah. do it with those who are having a hard time than you. So this, another thing, helps you to accept this hard mm-hmm. truth of life.
And also we have this concept of sugar-coated pill. You remember when we were kids and they used to give us those pills that were bitter?
Okay,
but they used to help us. They cured us from the sickness that we had.
From the sickness.
So these sugar-coated pills are exactly the same thing with the hardships. They yeah. might seem very hard and harsh, and I already told you that at the moment that you are going through those hardships, to believe that something harsh is happening to you is very difficult, but just as Zainab mentioned, through time, as time goes by and as you get mature and as you just evolve into a bigger personality, then you would understand that that hard situation was a blessing, perhaps.
It was a blessing, exactly.
It takes years to understand that, but it exists.
You remind me of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who says that when you will see the reward of the calamities you had mm-hmm. in this life over there, yeah. you'll say, I wish I had scissors and I would cut myself into pieces, getting all those calamities for myself.
And so, Zainab, also there's another point that we should consider. Satisfaction is the source of all the blessings. You know, you should be satisfied with whatever that happens to you.
Actually, you should be thinking that maybe my God wants this right now.
Exactly, yeah. And after all, we have to admit that life is not something, just as we talked about, just it's not a fairy tale. It's not going to end so happily, and you're not going to have all the cheery stuff in your life.
Except the hard truths of life.
Yes, you have to embrace the
and just
hardships.
In order to go through them, mm-hmm. I think we need to educate ourselves more about the
yeah,
worst.
Yeah, that is the point. Educating yourself, yeah. trying to ponder upon
and,
that.
And how to help yourself go through that time is that going through the verses of Quran, going through the hadith, going through the narrations. I think that's something that's really going to help you to accept those hard truths yeah. of life.
And
in fact, deal
believe
with them. It's not just accepting yeah. and acknowledging things. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that tough and hard truth is that all solutions are, I swear, in the Holy Book. I mean, whenever I go through some verse, I really find this is the answer to that particular yeah. question.
And in the end, I would say that the only single truth that would never change is that God is always there. So no matter how much hardships you're going through,
He is there.
Just trust in Him. He yes. absolutely is hugging you and walking you through that.
He's closer to you than
yeah.
the juggler rain. He's closer to you than your mother.
Exactly. And He's the kindest Almighty ever. So, dear listeners, this was all the time that we had for today's episode. It was such a nice session, Zainab. I enjoyed
Thank you,
it
Asma.
A lot. And
Same
I hope
here.
The audience had enjoyed that as well. So until another session, I leave you to the never-slipping eyes of Allah. May He protect you and shower you with His blessings. Thank you for listening. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A goat in the Pakistani city of Karachi has made the headlines for its not-so-ordinary looks. The animal owns strikingly long ears. Simba was only born last month, and his ears have already reached the length of 54 centimeters. The goat's breeder, Muhammad Hassan Narejo, says he has approached Guinness World Records to see if Simba can be included as the greatest of all time for this peculiar feature. The kid is in the center of attention, so he receives all sorts of help to live a smoother life. This includes a special harness for his ears and daily religious rituals to wish him good health. The breeder says why promoting Simba's image, he is trying to induce Pakistan as a major goat breeding nation. The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the gray green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyah is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground. There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day, since the menu largely includes local flavors.
Visitors and staff at a French zoo have celebrated the first birthday of twin pandas. The young bears were given a tasty treat of frozen cakes and other treats. As part of the event, five lucky visitors were also given the chance to participate in the celebrations behind the scenes with golden tickets. Other festivities included face painting and panda-themed activities. The baby pandas were born last August and now weigh 23 and 28 kilograms. They live with their mother at Zoo Parc de Bouval, where they have been on display since their arrival in 2021.
Many people develop deeper relationships with four-legged animals, treating them like their own kids. A Kenyan conservationist is one of them. 33-year-old Salome Lemasia has been a community ranger in Sierra Conservancy, northern Kenya, since 2015. The mother of four is stationed at a rhino sanctuary and is in charge of protecting a male rhino named Loijipo. At just a few days old, Loijipo was abandoned by his mother, possibly due to her being spooked by something. After being cared for, he was returned to the sanctuary under surveillance in an attempt to rewild him. 3 years on from his release into Sierra Wilderness, He is taking his time to carve out his territory, of course, with the help of Salome. The chest fever in the southern Indian city of Chennai is on a peak as the 44th International Chess Olympiad kicks off there. Students created a mammoth chessboard on the playground and dressed up as 32 chess pieces to promote the game. For 2 weeks, Chennai is hosting nearly 2,000 players from 188 countries. For the first time in nearly 100 years of history of the Chess Olympiad, India is playing host. The event will run until August the 10th. Ahead of the game, 150 underprivileged children from various government schools were given the opportunity to fly. These were the students who won in a district-level chess tournament. Excited spectators gather at the Solberg Airport in the U.S. for the 39th New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning.
We have about 45 balloons here today, including these spectacular special shapes, our signature New Jersey Lottery Sunny Days balloon. You can see the tiger. Unicorn is hiding behind there. Tasmanian Devil, unique photo, panda. We are having a spaceship. There's Billy the Kid. Spectacular presentation. You won't believe your skies this weekend.
Dozens of hot air balloons were test inflated in preparation for the real deal. The festival is considered the largest summertime event in New Jersey. Reddington City officials have predicted about 170,000 people will join the festival over the weekend. Weather forecasts say the sky are gentle enough for over 100 balloons to take flight in the morning and evening in mass ascents. And no one is more excited than the festival producer, who has been planning the event for months.
Including these spectacular special shapes, the balloons bring out the kid in everyone. You know, I've done this for a long time. This is the 39th annual one. But still, when I hear that propane whirring and these balloons going up, it makes the hair on my arm stand up.
The producer says these balloons will be handled by professional pilots and other balloons will be available for rides. The festival will last for 3 days, ending with food vendors, games, amusement rides, and other entertainment. There will also be a massive fireworks display as well as a nighttime feature of glowing balloons. The annual festival is the largest seasonal hot air balloon festival in North America. It draws in thousands of visitors every year.
You might think twice about throwing out your old trainers after this story. A startup in Tunisia breathes new life into old shoes as artists restore and even customize the footwear. The new business is called Kenenti and is located in the capital, Tunis. Here, the team uses fabrics, laces, and leather recovered from various factories for the repair work. The creative artists work on every detail during each project, even the soles of the shoes. The work aims to find solutions to shoe waste and reuse items instead of adding them to the world's landfills. Cherif Zerroui is the co-founder of Kenenti. He says the idea came to him 2 years ago when he discovered the number of shoes thrown away each year in Tunisia.
In France, there were 100 million pairs of shoes thrown away every year. This is a huge figure for us and for the ecosystem and for the earth. In Tunisia, it's almost the same given the population. There were 3 or 4 million shoes thrown away every year. So we thought of giving added value to these shoes, so we restored them.
Zerbui also says he is happy to create jobs for those willing to participate regardless of the educational degree. Besides shoes, these artists dabble in restoring worn-out handbags, giving them a brand new look. Many of the artists and interns say they are proud to be part of this unique project. They say they feel like a family there. The startup is the first trainer restoration business to be launched in North America. Would you buy a pair of scrap tire sandals? Well, in the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi, you will find all kinds of handmade sandals from recycled tires. The famously rugged footwear of the Viet Cong have traveled vast distances over the decades. Shoemakers use sharp knives and chisels to craft a sandal from huge tires. For those seeking a nod to yesteryear, the hard-sole sandals are available at markets and small stores alike, with prices ranging from $2,000 to $1,000. The Vietnamese first began making rubber sandals in the late 1940s during the first Indochina War against the French, using tires from ambushed army trucks. They found the sandals were cheap to make and survive well in wet, muddy and hilly conditions. Even in peacetime, the design remains popular for sustainability reasons. Living through a pandemic is strange as we are often locked indoors, but a UK-based Indian mechanical engineer made the best use of his time during the coronavirus lockdown and built an airplane. 38-year-old Ashok Ali Serial, who is also a private pilot, had long dreamt of a personal aircraft. He initially planned to order an aircraft kit and built it with his colleagues, but he says the 2020 lockdown left him with no choice but to complete it on his own. Now he has an aircraft which he has named after his youngest daughter, Dia. The plane can carry up to four people, including the pilot, and fly about 250 kilometers an hour. After getting clearance to fly, he flew across four European countries with his friends. He has also gone on a trip with his family of four.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 16th sermon, and here Imam Ali alayhi salam draws out the strategy that he has in mind with regards to the change that is required in the society, in the Islamic Ummah, that was going through a very tough time of redundancy because of the very wrong and wretched policies that were in place in the previous governments. And now it was Imam Ali alayhi salam's role to reverse this whole thing and to recalibrate it in the right direction. And Imam Ali alayhi salam then says something beautiful, and he says that these mistakes that in these wrong and false policies that the previous governments were holding on to were the reason why the community was being drowned in corruption and destruction and into the fire. And he gave the example of those horses and everything that I discussed previously, inshallah. Those who are interested can refer back to the previous session.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are discussing about this beautiful parable that Imam Ali alayhi salam gives here, and this example, when he talks about the fact that those people who are pious, a community that is pious, that holds on to policies that are based on truth, that hold on to policies that are based on piety. Piety here meaning that they are cautious. They are sensitive about what is correct and what is not. They are aware. They are careful. They are protective of what is correct. This is the meaning of taqwa. And those who are like that, it's as if they have climbed, they have mounted a tame horse. And this tame horse has got its reins and allows its rider to hold on to the reins. And then together it takes the people into heaven. So look, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, when a person does not have piety, if the society holds on to policies that are not based on piety, this society is like it's climbed on horses that are very wild, and they'll take you to the worst direction and just throw you, and you can't even control them. But if a person climbs on piety, that means if a person bases his whole society in piety, on piety, on being careful, on, you know, being sensitive about what is right and what is wrong, in being cautious, yes, it is difficult, but it is as if you as a community have mounted on a horse that is tame and that is giving you its reins. That means you are in control, because when you are pious, you are basing your life on something divine, on true principles, on things that are correct, on principles that God is aware of, and God gives barakah and blessings to those things, which is actually the reason why the universe is alive and is continuing to grow. So when you base yourself on those, then as if you're in a very calm horse, and it gives you its reins and it takes you to heaven. But on the other hand, if you just base your life, base your whole country and your whole society on false, wretched, destructive policies, then it's as if you are on a wild and uncontrollable horse. Because why is it wild and uncontrollable? Because that's how mistakes are. That's how wrongdoings are. That's how impiety is. It is not firmly based on any true reality in the universe. And therefore, it takes you into the worst directions of destruction.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Imam Ali alayhi salam beautifully says, Ala wa inna taqwa mataya dhululun humila alayha ahluha. That verily piety, being cautious, being careful, being concerned about the right and the wrong and taking that true path. Piety is such that it is like mataya dhululun, like a mount which is humble, humila alayha ahluha, whereby its people, that community that follows these principles of piety, they climb on it, they can stay on it, they are allowed to climb it, wa u'tu azimmataha, and they are given the reins to control it, to go where? Fa awradathumul jannah, and it takes them to heaven. So when this society follows these principles, you can imagine where it goes. These words are so beautiful, so powerful, that our scholars, they say that it is not possible for a human being to just explain them so easily. These examples, these parables that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions are superb in their articulation. They are mesmerizing in the way they, you know, cause a fervor in the heart. They awaken the deepest spiritual feelings towards the right things and the right thoughts and the right principles. These are the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is the peak of eloquence. This is the statements from the master of the believers and the commander of the faithful. This is Imam Ali alayhi salam. And when Imam Ali alayhi salam decides to speak the truth, when Imam Ali alayhi salam decides to take the path of justice, when Imam Ali alayhi salam wishes to analyze a society, then you have a master in his field, you know, taking all those details and bringing about that right worldview and the right thought in trying to create the right change that is required for the society. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, we have very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Murtaza Karimi, an Islamic expert from the Islamic Hausa of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh, during the tragedy of Karbala, which took place on the 10th day of the month of Muharram, 61 AH, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the very personality of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, it is, of course, most documented that he was the last person to go to the battlefield and, you know, that's all right, fight the enemy. So, and after Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, there was no man left in order to help, for example, the children and the women who were present at the tents on that time. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam went to, for example, the battlefield. First, he does some rajaz, you know, coming and going and explaining to the enemy, giving some pieces of advice, doing some du'as or something like that. And after that, the fight starts. And now Imam is alone, and we know that, statistically speaking, the number of the enemy's forces were many. That's why, naturally speaking, Imam will be killed. And, I mean, in the normal scene of the fight, you can resist, but at least you are killed. And this is what happened to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But what was the exact fight scene of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? This might be of interest to some of our dear listeners. I mean, how many wounds Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam took in the body? And, of course, this might be very much harsh for some of our listeners who are listening to that for the first time. But these are documented in the Shia legacy. And let's talk about that. That how much Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was wounded and how was for him to possible to resist and continue the fighting.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the questions, I mean, some people who are against the historical reports about the tragedy of Karbala, they say that the number of the wounds that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam received differ in different sources.
Yes.
And according to some of them, some of these numbers are, I mean, great numbers, and we cannot believe that a person has received all these great wounds and he survived and he could even continue to fight. So the first point, that it is true that we have different numbers. I mean, the wounds that the Imam Hussein alayhi salam received, we have different numbers. For example, according to one report, Imam had 33 wounds out of spears and 34 out of sword.
Yes.
Or in another narration, we are told about 70 wounds out of sword. In other narrations, the number is much greater, like 320.
Yes.
And in some narrations, we are told about 110 wounds. 120 is another number, 70, 180, and according to one report, it was more than 1,000. Now, the first question is that why we have all these differences in these reports? So some people who are against all these historical reports, they want to show that, so because of such differences, we cannot believe in any of them.
Okay.
But the point is that the history of Karbala, whatever happened on that day, are quoted from different people.
Yes.
And some of them, they witnessed the tragedy of Karbala.
Yes.
And when it comes to you counting the wounds of a person, it differs from one person to another based on your perspective and your criterion.
Okay.
I mean, sorry for giving such examples. So, for example, when a person has an accident, a very bad accident, and he is killed and he's badly injured.
Yes.
Now, one person might say that I saw that accident and the man was badly injured. Another person might describe it as saying that that man received, I mean, five injuries. And he's talking about the main wounds and injuries. For example, one in his hand, one in the right foot, for example, one in the left, one on the head, for example. So these are five. The next person might go more to the details. So he, enumerates all the wounds on just right hand of that person.
That's right.
So the point is that when it comes to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, some people who have narrated the story, yes, they just enumerate the great wounds on the body of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Yes. For example, one on his holy head, one, yes, on his right hand, left hand, and so on and, yes, so forth. But I mean, it's very possible for you to enumerate all the wounds even on one finger. I mean, yes, if you take into consideration all the small wounds on even one finger, okay, it might be more than 10.
That's right.
And you have 20 fingers, so it might be a great number.
Okay.
So my point is that the differences in the number of these narrations is absolutely understandable. It's, yes, based on the way that you want to describe the this tragedy.
And sorry to say this, but atrocity of the enemy forces was up to an extent that they were proud of wounding Imam al-Hussein.
That's the point. And we see in the narrations that
after
Imam being martyred, the, yes, enemies continued to blow their sword and, yes, spears on the holy body of Imam al-Hussein.
Trampling of the horse. Exactly. And they were proud. And they went back to the army. They said to the head of the army, I did this to the body, and I did that to the body, to get a reward or the money or something, yeah, like that, or position.
So the narrations specifically tell us that the body of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was filled with spears of the, yes, enemies. As you rightly mentioned, okay, every man was proud of doing,
yes,
that.
Unfortunately.
So there is no, practically speaking, difference between these, yes, statistics and numbers, yes, is absolutely understandable.
Okay.
As I mentioned, it depends on you how you want to enumerate the number of the wounds and injuries.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
And about continuing the war, Hashemites were famous for their bravery. And this has been documented that, for example, when one Hashemite go to the battlefield to fight the enemy forces of Yazid, at least there were so many people killed. Not only, for example, by Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas or Hazrat Qasim or Hazrat Ali al-Akbar and or Zuhair or the other, we can say, members of the army of Imam al-Hussein. When you talk about the bravery of the Hashemites and the power that they had, they were really skillful in fighting skills. So, and they were strong. And they were strong because during the history of Islam, you know the Hashemites for the bravery, for the chivalry, you know, and the fighting skills that they knew. But the case is that was Imam continuing the war after being wounded on?
Yeah, that's a kind of misunderstanding, uh-huh, because people say that, okay, according to these narrations, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam received 100 wounds and, yes, injuries. How did he continue to fight? The answer is that all these injuries did not happen all at once.
Uh-huh.
So gradually speaking, and finally Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred because, yes, of these, yes, great number of the injuries. So, yes, we are not saying that after receiving 100 injuries, Imam was able to continue the fight as he was doing that, mm-hmm, when he received like 20 injuries,
yes,
20 wounds.
Okay.
So yes, gradually speaking, Imam, lost a part of his strength.
Yes.
We are not talking, we are talking about the human being.
Yes.
So that is the cause that finally Imam Hussein alayhi salam is martyred.
Yes.
He is martyred because of receiving all these great number of the injuries and wounds. And so this is one point. We shouldn't think that, okay, Imam killed those many people when he had received all these injuries.
Yes.
No. Before that, Imam was, without any injury, and he was able to fight completely. This is one point. Second of all, as you rightly mentioned, we are talking about an imam, the, yes, son of Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was a hero in,
yes,
fighting the enemies.
Yes.
We are talking about this family.
Yes.
And for sure, physically speaking, all the Hashemites, and especially when it comes to the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, yeah, they were capable enough to fight the enemy.
Yes.
And that is why the number of the people killed by the Imam or his family members are great mm-hmm. numbers.
It's not even in the Rajas, we have that, we can say that if you come one by one,
mm-hmm.
then nobody will, we can say, overcome me.
Yeah, no, and this, that is why finally Umar ibn Sa'd decided to have a kind of a group attack on yes. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, yes, yes. and that was the tactic through which they were able yes. to martyr Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam.
Okay,
and the next point about the number of the people who were killed by the Imam is that the enemy of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam were afraid of the Imam.
Yes.
And the same is true about Abul Fadl Abbas and in yes. any war. In a war, when a hero comes to the scene, yes. so people are afraid of him.
Yes.
And when he attacks the enemy, the enemy might flee. And through that escape, some people are likely to be killed when they are fleeing.
Yes.
Because we have we are talking about horses, and then some of these people are trampled. So it's been mentioned yes. that some of the people who were killed, it was out of fearing Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam yes. and his greatness
yes.
and his dignity. And that's when right. they were fleeing, so they were trampled, and because of that, they were killed. So
that's all right.
To just give a summary of what I mentioned, first of all, the number of the wounds yes. are different from one report okay. to another, and we said that it's very natural. It depends on how you want to enumerate the yes. Wounds, and all these reports can be true. And
maybe the most tragic scene of all the wars in the history, because when you refer to Maqatil, you know, the martyrdom accounts of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, really some of the details are full of graphic violence. You cannot even exactly. mention them exactly. on the manaber, or we can't say picture them, for example, in a movie or in a painting or something like that. Really, really harsh. Even you know, just saying them on the words on your tongue will make you, I mean, move your heart.
Yeah, and this is one of the cases, one yes. of the points that make this tragedy
yes.
Unique in the whole history of mankind. So, and regarding this second question, as I mentioned, yes. Imam did not receive all these wounds yes. all at once. It was on a gradual process.
Yes.
So the more injuries the Imam received, he lost his power yes. and his strength.
Okay.
And that was the reason that that finally he was martyred. So we shouldn't think that Imam received 100 wounds and yes. then he continued to fight the yes. enemy as Imam was doing
and
that
this,
before.
And this was, the point is that this was a defensive war from the side of Imam, mm-hmm. not an attacking war,
exactly.
okay?
Yeah.
So Imam was defending himself, not attacking. So some people might ask that how an Imam is going to behead this, and kill that, okay?
Exactly.
So it was a defensive strategy from the side of Imam. And up to the last moment, he wants to guide them through words and wisdom. And this is interesting. I mean, even in the last moments of his life, when Shebrem the Zed Joshan is on the chest of the Imam to behead the Imam, that's Imam the is point. Giving pieces of advice, giving a hadith, I mean, right, guiding him into a right path.
Definitely.
And this is really, really, you know, unbelievable. Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for your nice elaboration regarding this topic. I mean, the wounds that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam took on the tragedy of Karbala. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Palestine declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This week, we'll be examining the Israeli dungeons of Palestine and look at the way in which debt is wielded to entrap Palestinians deeper into Zionist unfreedom. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. Before that, though, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation into the Western companies that profit from the Zionist dungeon system in Palestine.
The Israeli regime currently holds at least 4,450 Palestinians kidnapped in occupation dungeons. Among them are 160 children, 32 women, and 530 people held on administrative detention. Throughout 2021, the Israeli military arrested almost 8,000 Palestinians, including more than 1,300 children and 184 women. This system has generated massive profits for several well-known Western companies over the decades, who seem to have suffered little reputational damage for their role in suppressing the Palestinian people. So, which Western companies have profited and what services do they provide to those dungeons of occupation? US corporation Hewlett-Packard has provided servers, data storage and data security services for the Israeli prison system for the past 7 years. It has also signed deals worth over $1 million to provide similar services for the Israeli police. It has also been essential to the building of a biometric database of Palestinians for Israel occupation forces. Volvo Group, the Swedish multinational manufacturing corporation, is also intimately involved in the Israeli regime dungeons. Volvo and its subsidiary Merkavim provide the buses for the kidnapping and transporting of Palestinians to Israeli prisons. Volvo machinery has also been used in demolitions to aid Israel's ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The US company Motorola has also had a very key role in this infrastructure of spatial dominance. It supplies the Israeli police with the Astro 25 communication system through which the officers interact with each other. Motorola Solutions also set up the wide area surveillance system known as Motor Eagle for the Israeli Ministry of Defense. This system is essential to the illegal settlement network and apartheid wall infrastructure. Motorola Solutions even went as far as providing a special encrypted telecommunications system tailor-made for the Israeli military. The Mountain Rose project was designed to prevent the resistance from penetrating Israeli military communications. Motorola has also provided key components for Israeli arms companies like Rafael and Elbit Systems subsidiary IMI Systems. G1 Secure Solutions was previously known as G4S Israel, a subsidiary of the British outsourcing behemoth G4S. The company had over 7,000 workers in the apartheid entity and provides detection systems to the Israeli prison service. It was later contracted to carry out maintenance of the integrated management systems within the Israeli prison system. This included maintaining the CCTV system and control rooms. The company also provided ankle monitors for the jailers to attach to the legs of Palestinians. G4S was campaigned against relentlessly and eventually sold off its Israeli subsidiary. However, it has remained a part of the Israeli police infrastructure through its 25% ownership of the Policity Corporation. Policity trains Israeli police officers on a plethora of suppressive measures, from crowd control to interrogation techniques and undercover operations. Just as G4S was pressured to sell the Israeli subsidiary engaged in this work, so too must be the other Western companies party to the crimes of the Israeli regime.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel.